All right, 1 Kings 11, if you would please. 1 Kings chapter 11. We've wrapped up last week with the end of 1 Kings chapter 10, talking about Solomon's trade and his wealth and all of that. We talked about the ships that brought gold from Ophir and the horses that he brought out of Egypt and all of that kind of thing. And that was just kind of a summary. 1 Kings chapter 11 is a very crucial turning point in the story of Solomon's reign. Okay, you notice the first word here in chapter 11, verse 1 is but. Okay, there's a contrast here. So chapters 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 have been primarily positive things with Solomon, right? God appeared to him and said, what do you want? And he asked for wisdom, and God was pleased with that. And then he built the house of the Lord, and he built his own house, and he established commerce and trade. He had ships, and he had, you know, all of these ventures going on, and you have all these positive things. And then we start out in chapter 11, verse 1, with a contrast. But King Solomon loved many strange women, together with the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Zidonians, and Hittites, of the nations concerning which the Lord said unto the children of Israel, ye shall not go in unto them, neither shall they come in unto you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. Solomon clave to these in love. So you see here the groundwork for the downfall of Israel. Many times we think of Jeroboam and the kings after that as being the turning point into idolatry for the nation of Israel. I think we need to understand that Solomon was the one that took Israel into idolatry. In fact, it's far worse than we often think, because there's just a few statements here, and then, you know, by chapter 12, we're talking about Rehoboam. It's not a long and detailed listing here, but this is very significant. All right, now, look with me, if you will, at God's command. Hold your place here and turn back to Deuteronomy chapter 17 for just a minute. Deuteronomy chapter 17. It's kind of, it's referenced in a general statement here in 1 Kings 11 of the children of Israel that they were not to intermarry with these other peoples. And the statement was very specific. They will turn your hearts away towards their gods. Do you remember the name of the man that was hired to curse Israel and he never could? Who was that? That was Balaam, okay? He was not allowed to curse Israel, but a few chapters later, the scripture says that the people, I'm trying to remember now, that was Balak, which was the Moabites, right? It was king of Moab. So it says that he, through the counsel of Balaam, caused Israel to sin. So Balaam said, look, God's not going to let me curse these people outright, but if you want them to lose the blessing of their God, I'll tell you how you do it. And so they had a big worship service. They invited the Israelites, hey, we're having a big special dinner. We want you to come. Well, they would have a feast and all of that. But as we're going to talk about probably this morning, I think we'll get to it today, a lot of times the worship of these idols involved immorality. That was part of the worship ceremony. And so the Israelites got involved with this idolatrous worship, and, you know, committing fornication was the way you worship the god or goddess of fertility. And so in that same story in Numbers, you have a story of one of the princes of Israel and one of the daughters of a prince of Moab, and they're marching down Main Street and heading into the Israelite man's tent, and everybody knows why. Well, then it was one of Aaron's sons, Phinehas, who went and put a spear through them, you know, and put a stop to it, right? But what I'm saying is that they hadn't been out of Egypt how long, and they're already encountering this. I mean, that's exactly why God said you're not to intermarry with them. But there's a specific command for the king here. Have I stalled long enough for you to find Deuteronomy 17? All right, verse number 15. Thou shalt in any wise set him king over thee, whom the Lord thy God shall choose. One from among thy brethren shalt thou set king over thee. Thou mayest not set a stranger over thee. But he shall not multiply horses to himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt, for the end that he should multiply horses. Did Solomon pass or fail on that one? Yeah, he failed. All right, middle of verse 16. For as much as the Lord hath said unto you, ye shall henceforth return no more that way. What does that mean? God wanted them to have a complete break from Egypt. Didn't want them to go back. Verse 17. Neither shall he multiply wives to himself. That doesn't sound very ambiguous, does it? It sounds pretty straightforward and clear. Neither shall he multiply wives to himself that his heart turn not away. Neither shall he greatly multiply to himself silver and gold. How many of these commands did Solomon obey? And on how many of these did he fail? Failed on all of them. Horses out of Egypt, made a connection with Egypt, married the daughter of Pharaoh, you know, all multiplied wives, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? So this was God's command. Was this accessible to Solomon? Did he know God's expectation? Yes. All right? So that is God's command. What's the choice that Solomon made? Back to 1 Kings chapter 11. You know the choice. But we're already told here, Solomon loved many strange women. Look at verse number 3. Now, I'm trying very hard to just let that phrase go. Okay? Strange women. Because I'm sure that it would be reciprocated, right? Men are strange too sometimes. But what that means is strangers. They did not belong to the nation of Israel. Okay? Loved many strange women. Verse 3. He had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines. And his wives turned away his heart. Okay? 1 times 2 is 2. I'm pretty sure that's multiplying wives. Okay? But by the time you get to 700 plus 300 spares, you know, you have way, way, way crossed the line. Solomon, at this point, is governed by what? Is he governed by the scriptures? Is he governed by principle? He's living by his desires, right? He's living by his desires. And, you know, that was the basis for his, some of them were political marriages, I think. But nonetheless, his basis was just, I'm the king, I have enough money, I can have whatever I want. And what we see in Solomon is that the truth, I mean, he's a living illustration of the proverb that says, death and hell are never full, so the eyes of man are never satisfied. Okay? Well, however much you have, there's always one more commercial, there's always one more flyer. I'd like to have that one too. I mean, whether it's in the realm of things or in his case, multiplying wives or possessions or whatever it is, the lust of the eyes is that desire for other things. That Solomon, as much as he had, never satisfied that, you know, to the satisfaction of a sin nature and flesh. Years ago, I heard this. Somebody asked Bill Gates when he crossed the threshold of, I think it was $1 billion. You know, how much money is enough? And what was the general tenor of the response? Just a little bit more. Okay? The eyes of man are never satisfied. But you see here, God's command, Solomon's choice. It's stated there in verse number 1, he loved many strange women. Now notice the next phrase after that, Solomon loved many strange women. What's the next couple of words there? Together with. Right? I think that indicates that Pharaoh's daughter was first, and then the others were added later. Okay, now that may not have been his first wife if David had set something up for him, you know, before his death, but the first of the foreign wives, I think, was Pharaoh, or the daughter of Pharaoh. Pharaoh, the alliance with Pharaoh. Okay, that when this would happen in the context of kingdoms, when the child of one king would marry the child of the king from the other nation, it was basically a peace alliance, right? Because what they're saying is, you know, you're not going to attack us as long as your son or daughter is here with us. You know, you're not going to attack us as long as your child's here with us. So it was a peace, it was an alliance, it was a peace treaty. We talked about this a couple of chapters ago when in chapter 9, when it says Pharaoh had taken Gezer and burned it with fire and he gave it to Solomon as a present. Solomon went in and rebuilt it, and then he moved his wife that was Pharaoh's daughter, he moved that wife over there. Interesting, in chapter 9 and verse 24, it says the city was holy, so he moved Pharaoh's daughter out. Okay, maybe he knew something was up, or maybe Pharaoh's daughter just really did not want to be there in Jerusalem with the house of God. Either way, is that not exactly what God said in Deuteronomy? You multiply wives, are going to turn away your heart. It's exactly what God had said. So Solomon loved many strange women. So you have, what was the, when we read in Deuteronomy 17, what was the first country or nation that was addressed? Do not make an alliance with this group. In Deuteronomy 17, anybody remember? Egypt. What's the first marriage that Solomon made that's recorded here? Egypt. Now, when did that happen? Early on. I mean, this happened before Solomon built the temple, or before the temple was completed, because back in 1 Kings chapter 9, it says that Pharaoh's daughter lived there in Jerusalem with him until he'd finished the house of the Lord and his own house, and then he rebuilt Gezer, and then he made her her own house. But he had married Pharaoh's daughter, I'm going to say, within the first 10 years of his being king. All right, when did the downfall happen? I'm going to say probably at least 20 years later. Okay? So it did not happen immediately, which is why I labeled this heading the groundwork for the downfall. Not every consequence happens immediately. All right? Some of you are debating timing right now. Are we going to have any more frost? Can I go ahead and plant my garden? All right? Maybe you already have, and then it got it and you got to replant it. But if you plant seeds, how quickly do they sprout? Well, there's some variation depending on what you planted, but you don't plant it today and then tomorrow you've got sprouts, right? You ever do that? You plant it, take a little styrofoam cup, put a little soil in it, plant seeds, let the kids, watch that, put it in the kitchen window or whatever. I mean, the kids are very impatient. Oh, do we have anything? Oh, it didn't work, and then finally a few days later something starts to pop up. Well, the consequences of sin are often like that. The seeds have been planted, the course of action has been set in motion, but it doesn't always pop up right away. Sometimes it doesn't, mature until later. But you have here the groundwork for Solomon's downfall. Okay, so here we're told, I believe the first one was Pharaoh's daughter, but then you add to that the women of Moab, Ammon, Edom, Zidon, and the Hittites. Okay, who are Moab and Ammon? Yeah, the sons of Lot as a result of the incestuous relationship with his own daughters. Okay, God had specifically told them not to intermarry with them and to avoid them. Okay, what were the influences that led Lot's daughters to get him drunk and to think that they needed to, have a relationship with their dad to preserve seed? Sodom. Yes. Okay. The life living in Sodom is what caused them to think that way. What do you think they taught their kids? The mindset of Sodom. So that was Moab and Ammon from very far back had carried along that same mentality. Edom is another name for whom? Esau. Okay? So the Edomites are the descendants of Esau. Zidon, that's an alternate spelling. It says the Zidonians. If you put an S on the front of that word, that's another way that it's spelled sometimes in our Bible. Sidon. Okay? Tyre and Sidon. Okay, those are coastal cities in what's often referred to as the area of Phoenicia, would have been north of Israel. Okay, the Hittites. Now, this one was kind of interesting to me. We see that term in the Old Testament sometimes, the Hittites. It's often in a long list of other ites. Okay, but where does that originate? Where did it come from? I don't think so. If you go back to Genesis chapter 23, David was trying to buy a burying place when Sarah had died, okay? And he said, you know, they said, well, yeah, we'll help you out. And he said, well, you speak to the sons of, anybody remember? Heth, okay? It was a different name, but it was the, he said, speak to the sons of Heth that they would give me this field. And yes, he said, yeah, I'll sell it to you. Well, the Hittites, the spelling, the consonants are the same. Heth or the Hethites with different vowels would be Hittites. Okay, so a lot of the commentators trace the Hittites back to the descendants of Heth. In other words, you know, the sons of Heth were ones that already lived in the land of Canaan when Abraham got there. So they were longtime residents of that region. What was that region characterized by? Immorality, idolatry, all that kind of stuff. When God brought Israel out of Egypt, he said, I'm going to give you this land. I'm not going to give it to you because you're the biggest or you're the best. I'm paraphrasing now. But God said, I'm giving it to you because of the sins of all those people, right? He said, I'm kicking them out because of their idolatry and their immorality and all. He lists a bunch of different forms of wickedness. Okay? God basically says, I'm kicking them out because of all of this. So they were all, their history steeped in idolatry and false worship. God knew what he was doing when he said, don't you intermarry with them. They will influence you away from the worship of God. Well, guess who Solomon begins to bring into his household? Egypt, Moab, Ammon, Edom, Sidon, Hittites, and there's probably a lot of others, you know, to reach the total that he reached by the end of his life. So you have here a very clear statement. Now, when did all of these processes start? I mean, these things were going on, I think. Some of these marriages were no doubt going on during the years that Solomon's building the temple, building his own house. You know, some of these wives already lived in his house when Solomon, you know, had the dedication prayer and the glory of God falls at the dedication of the temple and, you know, all of these things. Do you remember in chapter 9? When God appeared to Solomon the second time, can you turn back just a page or two with me? 1 Kings chapter 9. It came to pass when Solomon had finished the building of the house of the Lord and the king's house and all that he desired to do, the Lord appeared to Solomon the second time. In the first few verses, God says, you know, basically, I'm going to do what I said I was going to do and bless this house. I'm going to hear your prayer. All right, verse 4, if thou wilt walk before me, then here's what I will do. Verse number 6, but if ye at all turn from following me, ye or your children, and will not keep my commandments and my statutes that I've set before you, but you go and serve other gods and worship them, then will I cut off Israel out of the land which I'd given them. What was God specifically warning Solomon against when he appeared to him the second time? Idolatry. You know what that tells me? God knows our weaknesses. God also knows, even if it's not, you know, a weakness per se, like an ongoing thing, God knows the situations we're going to face. So in other words, when God starts ringing your bell, you better pay attention. Instead of saying, oh, I don't have to worry about that, or I don't have to deal with that, maybe God is trying to fortify you because he knows exactly what's coming up around the corner. God appeared to Solomon, I think that was about the midpoint, around the 20-year time frame, about halfway through his reign as king. And he specifically warned him against idolatry, and here's the judgment that'll happen if you do that. Within 10 years after that time, guess what Solomon's doing? He's allowing his wives to worship other gods in Jerusalem, and then he's, by the end of his life, Solomon's participating in it. Okay? Just mind-blowing. But you see there the phrase at the end of verse 2, after it lists all the different ones, it said, Solomon clave unto these in love. That's the same word that we see in Ruth chapter 1 where it says Ruth clave to her mother-in-law. If you remember the story from 2 Samuel 23, and talking about David's mighty men, it says one of them, you know, fought all day long and his hand clave to the sword. That this word to cleave means to cling or to stick to or to follow closely. So it has the idea of to hold tightly to. Ironically, that word cleave means to hold tightly to. And then a cleaver is that which divides instead of holds together. You know, like a meat cleaver is what I tried to look it up, the origin of those words, just because I was trying to find out how could two words be so very different. And it's because English borrows from French and German and Latin and all of the sources. But this word here, to cleave, means to hold tightly to. Ruth clave to her mother-in-law. David's mighty man, his hand clave to the sword. Genesis 34, Shechem, the son of Hamor, clave to Dinah. Remember when he took Jacob's daughter Dinah and defiled her, and then the brothers tried to take out revenge for that. But here, what this is saying is this wasn't just a casual thing on the part of Solomon. He was all in. He was holding to it just absolutely as tightly as he possibly could. Okay, he clave to these strange ones. So was he listening when God said, be careful that they don't lead you away? No, he wasn't. So what was Solomon's choice? He loved many strange women. He clave to them in love. All right? So what is then the consequence? You have God's command. Don't multiply horses. Don't multiply wives. Don't follow other gods. What was Solomon's choice? He loved many strange women. He clave to them in love. What was the consequence? What's the outcome here? Verse number 3, and he had 700 wives, princesses, 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. It's very interesting. His wives turned away his heart. This word turned away has some literal uses. Sometimes it means to stretch out, like if they would set up the frame of a tent. Some of you were involved in setting up a tent here, a couple years ago when we used that for homecoming and we set it up ourselves. And, you set up the framework. Well, then you take the tarp and you stretch it out. Well, in the process, you kind of wrap it around or bend it around the frame and attach it where the hooks are and so forth. It has some literal meanings like that. But this word very often is used figuratively, to turn. It's used, if you've got a creek, and then there's a sharp angle in it, would we say that bends or turns? Okay, does that shorten the path of the creek or does that stretch it out? Does that make it longer? It makes it longer. But that idea of to turn, it's used figuratively. This word is used of to turn away the heart. It's also used in the Bible. Sometimes it's translated as incline. Remember, have you ever read this phrase, incline my heart? Or my son, incline your ear? It means to stretch or to bend, literally. Okay, so what does incline your heart mean? It means to stretch or bend or lean in this direction. To incline your ear might mean this, But if it's not literal, still figuratively, it is to lean or bend or stretch in that direction. Okay? So, did Solomon immediately go into idolatry? No. I mean, he dedicated the house of the Lord and he offered sacrifices at the prescribed times and he set it up where the tax money paid for all of the daily sacrifices and all that. He took care of all the expenses. But over time, his heart was stretched, bent, turned away from the Lord. Solomon's most famous work was the building of the temple, right? At least in the Bible, that was his most famous work. And yet his heart was turned away. You say, well, how could that happen? Well, let's talk for a minute about the influence that ladies can have on men. Okay? I mean, around here, you see maybe some of the young men, if they start wanting the ladies to notice them or they start trying to catch the attention of a certain lady, sometimes that causes them to dress a little nicer, maybe to start paying attention to hygiene for the first time in their life. Okay, maybe it causes them to act better, at least comparatively. They're better than they did before. Doesn't mean they act well, but it's better than it was. Maybe they act goofier because they're all nervous and trying to get their attention, right? Maybe it causes them to talk differently when ladies are around. All right, now let's talk about in the context of a marriage. Can wives get guys to do things they wouldn't normally do? Yeah. I spent more time in Hobby Lobby than I ever would voluntarily. Amen. Because I have a wife, right? I've spent time looking for decorations because I have a wife. We have flowers in the yard because I have a wife. Okay? Yes, Brother Stevens has an orchard in the yard because he has a wife. And 37 rose bushes, is that about right? Did I miss a few? Okay. I mean, just think about it. Most guys are not going to agonize over paint chips and do I get this shade or this shade? It's give me white, blue, gray, I'm out of here. You know, give me something basic and I'm out of here. The difference between the guys' dorms and the girls' dorms at the college, if you were to go in and take a tour, sometimes we've had an open house and take a tour, you know, other than the smell, yes. I mean, other than the odors, you just look, you know, the guys' dorms, there's the snack bins are well supplied, and there's not much on the walls, okay? The ladies, there's, you know, there's flowers and there's decor and, you know, now, sometimes when this interest in a young lady pops up, well, then pictures start showing up, but it's not necessarily decor for the sake of decor. You see what I'm saying? But, yes, at our house, we have pictures, and we have colors that all coordinate because I have a wife. So, you know, she's influenced us for the positive in that way, right? That it would probably be all contractor white, and who cares if I were making the decision? You know, we'll spend the extra money on food, okay? That is the difference between a party that guys plan and a party that girls plan. If guys plan it, there's very minimal decorations and the extra money goes to meat or dessert, okay? When ladies plan it, the decorations are fantastic and the food's like this, okay? It is what it is. It is. It makes you wonder who had to sacrifice their fingers for it. But you understand what I'm saying. Can wives get their husbands to do things that they would not otherwise do? Absolutely. Yeah, there you go. Eve influenced Adam even though he knew better. Okay? So, yeah, and if I open the floor right here, we could have the knockdown drag out. I mean, now, in fairness to the ladies, they would have to probably also say, yes, because I have a husband, I do things I don't enjoy or I wouldn't naturally choose, right? But in this context, in talking about Solomon and how his wives can influence him, over time, they influenced him to do things that he said he would never do. Okay? Some of you have had that same experience. It's hopefully not, you know, a violation of your relationship with God. Maybe it's just simply, you know, to live in a certain area, or maybe it's to have pets, or, you know, to have a certain color or to wear a certain thing or whatever. You know, there are things that you say you'll never do and then you end up doing it. But in this case, Solomon, when it comes to a spiritual sense, he was going to follow the Lord. And then by the end of his life, he was doing things he said he'd never do. Why? Because of the influence of his wives. How did that happen? Well, to quote that great theologian Barney Fife, if you ever saw the episode where Ellie Mae was running for council and Barney got conned into signing the petition, and Andy's just scolding him for that. And he says, "Andy, she's got ways." In other words, she has ways of getting me to do things I wasn't planning on doing. Sometimes those are nice and sweet, and, you know, sometimes they are, you know, or, you know, sometimes it involves silence or, you know, conflict. But whatever weapon is used, you know, they know how to get the outcome they want. Yes, I said it that way. Okay. I'm just saying what everybody else is thinking, okay? Yeah, I think after this, pastor's going to let me start a session on Christian home, all right? Whatever tool was used, they got Solomon to do what they wanted him to do. Okay? Now, Solomon backed himself into an unnecessary corner by trying, I mean, it's hard enough to do right by one wife and one husband, right? It's hard enough to fulfill your biblical duty there, to please, you know, Paul said, under the inspiration of the Spirit of God, he that's married cares for the things of this world, how he may please his wife, and the woman that's married cares for the things of this world, how she can please her husband. It's hard enough to keep up with that. Well, now multiply it times 700. Now, that was a self-inflicted wound. Okay, Solomon did that to himself. But I don't even want to try to imagine, how did he keep the peace? You know, so what does he do? He gives a gift to this one. Now he's got 45 over here that are jealous because they didn't get a gift today, right? So, or he says something sweet to this one and these over here are watching. I mean, it's constant conflict that he brought on himself with his own lusts, his own desires. But over time, he doesn't want them. All right, let me get myself in trouble one more time. It's bad enough when one wife is mad at you, right? Your only wife is mad at you. That's bad enough. Can you imagine having 500 mad at you at the same time? So what's he doing? I mean, at a certain point, I mean, he's called, the bucket brigade isn't putting out the fire. You know, he's calling for the ladder truck and, you know, maybe praying for a hurricane. You know, he's got these fires that he's trying to put out. And what does he do eventually? He tries to do anything to keep the peace. I think that's one of the ways that Solomon very likely got himself drawn into these things. But whether it was through trying to pacify a situation, whether it was through a sweet request from, you know, these different wives, Solomon got drawn into worship. It says they turned away his heart from the Lord his God. Verse number 4, it came to pass when Solomon was old, literally in the time of his old age, that his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not perfect with the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father. That term perfect does not mean without fault. That word perfect is from the same word, the same root word where we get the term shalom. You've heard that one, most of you, right? What does shalom mean? Peace. The root of that term peace means wholeness. Okay? If your mind and heart are divided and torn in different directions, do you have peace? You have anxiety? You have conflict? Things are disturbed. But peace is, you know, when everything is fitting together. Everything is whole. Okay? And the idea of heart not perfect or a heart being perfect is used positively and negatively in the Old Testament. But the idea of a heart that is perfect is the one that is wholly focused on whatever. A heart that is wholly dedicated. Of David, his heart was perfect with the Lord his God, meaning his whole focus was on pleasing God. Okay? That it wasn't like, well, I have to give God something, and then I can give this one something. He wasn't torn in multiple directions when it came to his worship. His whole focus was the worship of God and having a right relationship with God. That's the idea of a perfect heart. Well, Solomon, at one time, that was his focus, but he lost that focus. How does that happen to you and me, potentially? That doesn't happen usually overnight. How long have these relationships been ongoing? Now, I realize it's a lot different with Solomon, when even if you have 50 wives, a lot different than your context. But, I mean, how long does it take? You know, ladies, if you were to be forthcoming, there are probably things that you thought when you first got married, oh, I can get this changed. And it took a lot longer than you thought. Maybe it still hasn't happened. You know, Sometimes people will look at my wife and say, why don't you make him behave? And she said, I've been trying for 24 years. I'm about to give up. I don't think it's going to work. Okay? So, but what I'm saying, as the relationship grows and matures, you know, there's processes there. But how long have these relationships been ongoing? Well, I mean, you ever stop and think about this? How long was Solomon king? 40 years. All right? If we just talk about the wives, not the 300 concubines, if we just talk about the wives, how many weddings a year was that? Ten weddings a year for 40 years is 400. I mean, that's basically a wedding a month on average. I mean, there's the bacon of the month and the sausage of the month and the flower of the month. Oh, this is Solomon's wife of the month, you know. You mean one of the collection? No, this is a new one. So, some of you know, over time, you know, his total added up. But what I'm saying is, how long was he married to Pharaoh's daughter? Probably 30 years, 35 years, you know, very long time like that. Some of these others, 10, 15, 20, 25 years. I mean, some of the other ones were added later on. But I'm saying that his heart being turned away from God didn't happen like that. It happened as a process over a period of time. Now, what's the takeaway for you and me? How does a heart being turned away from God happen to you and me? Does it happen instantaneously? Occasionally, but that's not normally the way it happens. Occasionally, there's some dramatic or traumatic incident that happens, and it causes just an instant shift. You know, sometimes people will blame God. Why could you let this happen? Okay? But more often, a heart turning away from God for us is a step, 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 step. I mean, none of you got out of your car this morning, took one giant leap and landed in the seat where you're sitting now. Okay? How'd you get there? Step, 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 step. I just took, what, 7 or 8 steps? And now I'm 10 or 15 feet from where I was. Well, I mean, if you spread that out over time, if I just take a step every couple of months, well, in 2 or 3 years, how far away am I going to be from where I started? See what I'm saying? And how does a heart that at one time was perfect with the Lord end up being turned away? More often than not, it's small steps over a period of time. Something changes in your prayer time, or maybe it goes away. Something changes in your Bible reading time. Maybe you still do it, but it's just kind of perfunctory. It's a duty. It's a box to check. It's not with intent. You know, maybe something happens with church attendance. I'm thankful for our church. But you know how many people during the COVID time went away and then never came back? You know, something like that happens. Well, then, you know, you get away and never come back. That's churches all over the country have that similar experience, right? But how does a heart get turned away? A step at a time. Just a little bit at a time. But if I were to just take, I don't know, 50, 75, 100 steps, I could be at the back door within a matter of a minute, minute and a half. Even if I'm just taking my time, I'm not at a sprint. In the same way, if we are just slowly taking steps away from where I ought to be in my relationship with the Lord, it doesn't take all that much time until I'm a long way away from where I ought to be. Long way away from where I used to be. That's what happened to Solomon. He had a task. He was building the house of the Lord. He had all of these ventures he's trying to get going. And sometimes it's the busyness of things that takes us away, but sometimes it's just simply idleness or ease. I mean, if you're in Solomon's position, you could take vacation 26 weeks a year, right? I mean, that's a good way to get out of the habit of worship of the Lord. I'm not going to say church because this wasn't church at the time of Solomon. That would be our terminology. But you understand what I'm saying? How did Solomon's wives turn away his heart? A little bit at the time. And because he loved, the Bible says he clave to these in love, when they tried to influence them, he listened. He wanted their approval. He wanted their attention. He wanted to have a cordial relationship and not a fight all the time, which means he started to make steps to make them happy. And ultimately, the very man who built, just a few weeks ago, we looked at the temple and talked about how many tons of gold were involved in that and all the elaborate construction work. The very man who built that, prayed the dedication prayer, saw the cloud come down and the glory of God. That same man built altars for idolatrous worship to gods that were sometimes worshipped by human sacrifice, sometimes by prostitution as part of the worship service. That same guy got involved in those things. Why? A step at a time, he got away. He was listening to the wrong influences. Where did it start? It started with a choice to disobey God's word. God said, don't do this. Solomon did it. He made a choice. He laid the groundwork, and eventually he would end up in idolatry. Jeroboam didn't start idolatry in Israel. Solomon did. We'll look at some of those specific idols next week. But what should we take away from this? God, help me. Right? Sometime today, get alone with the Lord and just say, Lord, have I taken steps in a direction that I shouldn't, in a direction that's dangerous? If I have, would you show me? Don't do it unless you mean it, because God will. He knows exactly what to do there. But I don't want to be like Solomon in that respect. But sometimes it's the small things that we have a tendency to write off or to excuse. Those small steps eventually added up to big, big changes in the life of Solomon. That was the groundwork for his downfall. God help us to choose obedience and to be sensitive to small steps and return to where we need to be. Thank you, Lord, for your word.